Welcome to the Young Turks. It's Friday, so that must mean that we have a power panel. I actually hate that animation.
I love that.
It makes me feel strong.
Hate every part of it, but it's okay. It's a Friday thing, so I'm just going to accept it. Anyway, welcome to the Power Panel. Welcome to Friday's show. Mark Thompson, Sue Ann Robinson. She is a new guest for our Power Panel. Looking forward to having you on.
Thanks for
being here. Ben Mankiewicz.
What's up? Sue Ann's a watch matches her dress, so like she came to play.
Yeah, she did.
TYT
colors.
Yeah, that's right.
So let me tell you a little something about Sue Ann, because she's incredible. She's been practicing law for 11 years.
Yes. Since I was one.
She is a shareholder at Robinson Caddy Law, where she represents individuals and corporations in high stakes litigation and criminal defense matters. She served as lead counsel on hundreds of trials in private practice and is a former assistant state attorney. Damn.
Wow.
Wow, it reads like my resume.
Yeah, I was going to say, Mark, why don't you tell us a little about yourself now?
Maybe later we'll talk about what I've done.
Right. Wow.
Yeah, so you know when American Idol began? They'd tell you like, welcome to America. That was Mark. So it's like parallel careers.
Yeah.
I love it.
Well, welcome. You're an accomplished person.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
It's our pleasure. All right. Use the hashtag TYTLive to tweet to us during the show. And I'm glad that you're here, Sue Ann, because there are a few stories that we need some legal expertise on. So you'll definitely chime in for that. All right. You guys ready?
Let's do it.
Even though Greg Gianforte was charged with misdemeanor assault just two nights ago, turns out that he did win the special election in Montana, and he is now a U.S. House representative. Now, for those of you who might have missed the story, he did pull a victory despite his alleged assault of a reporter Wednesday night at his campaign headquarters. Ben Jacobs, a reporter for The Guardian, said that Gianforte body slammed him after he attempted to ask the candidate a question about the House Republican health care bill. Now, keep in mind that a lot of the votes or a lot of the ballots had been turned in early. We'll get into the numbers in just a second. So people had already voted before this whole incident made headlines. But initially, Gianforte did not issue an apology, but instead claimed that Jacobs grabbed him by the wrist before the two fell to the ground. That was not true. The audio recording that Jacobs had reinforced his story, and there was also a Fox News reporter there who saw what happened and also agreed with Jacobs.
A whole Fox crew, not just a reporter.
Right, but the reporter is the one who wrote about it and completely corroborated the account given by Jacobs. Now, with that said, unfortunately, Gianforte still won. And after he won, he did make a statement and apology in regard to the assault situation. Let's take a look.
I learned a lesson.
Yeah.
And no, please. I need to share something from my heart here, and I just ask you to bear with me. And when you make a mistake, you have to own up to it. That's the Montana way.
Amen.
Last night I made a mistake. And I took an action that I can't take back. And I'm not proud of what happened. I should not have responded in the way that I did. And for that, I'm sorry.
And you're forgiven.
Well, glad he didn't have any firearms available. It would have been a horrible mistake.
Right.
First, the Montana way is that you completely lie about it and say that it didn't actually go down. And then, once you get sufficient political pressure placed upon you, then you own up to it.
When there's no danger in any way in issuing the apology, right? So they only lied about it.
There is danger because he's still facing his criminal charges. But it doesn't really matter because there's only three qualifications for his job. He's 25, he resides in Montana, and he's a US citizen. So there's nothing that's gonna disqualify him with this charge.
And it's misdemeanor assault and not felony assault. So, you know, the likelihood of, it's not like he's gonna be taken away from his job just to do time.
He could still serve
right
in his position from jail. That's happened before.
But even so it's but not there'll a big be deal. But there'll be no jail because it's misdemeanor. So
right, and all, as a all practical likely. Matter, he actually didn't actually admit to anything specific. He just said I did something. So he kind of left the door open. Should it really turn into a cat fight legally?
Right, he could say I was apologizing for losing my temper and not handling it in the right way, being assaulted by grabbed by the wrist. Because reporters are always so the guy was holding a microphone. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was holding a tape recorder. So he put it in his, I guess he held it to his wrists with one hand and then I guess grabbed Gianforte's wrists with the other hand. That seems like a logical human move. I'm always doing this.
Right.
Yeah, Jesus.
You're always wrestling with people that you're trying to get to answer your question.
Yeah, ask to answer my, and I, yeah. So I mean, it is, and you know, for Annie, you know, for as long as you've known me, I love to talk about apologies and how bad apologies are. That is mm-hmm. All-time bad apology. It does a great disservice to Sean Connery along the way with it's the Montana way.
Right.
I mean, he didn't even say that in a cool way.
You're talking about the Chicago way?
It's the Chicago way.
His apology is one thing, but I think what was also a little worrisome was the response from his supporters, right? And just their lack of concern over the assault that occurred, the treatment of reporters, this lack of, you know, I guess interest in protecting reporters' rights, our constitutional rights, the First Amendment. I mean, if this had happened to a reporter from Fox News, a conservative reporter, I would venture to say that this would be something that Republicans would be ranting and raving about nonstop for like the next month, right? Oh, they don't care about the Constitution, they don't care about freedom of press, but first of all, the assumption was that this was a liberal reporter, even though he didn't even know who the reporter was. He had to ask which publication the reporter was from. So how are you already assuming that it's a liberal reporter? And nonetheless, it doesn't even matter what a reporter's political ideology is. You don't get to assault that reporter. You don't get to assault anyone, right?
Just imagine if the reporter, if what Gianforte and his minions had said was actually true. Suppose a reporter had assaulted a man running for Congress. I mean, their reaction, they'd still be talking about it.
That's right.
Right? But here, the guy actually with all the power committed the assaults. And not only did they lie about it, he blamed the victim. And then his aides bragged that over the last 24 hours, they raised something like $100,000. Is that the number that I read? Let's tens of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. I think they raised $100,000 and claimed that they raised it on that. That they used that, so now they use the assault to generate money, blame the victim, and then issue an apology for nothing that doesn't include the part where I completely lied about it to your faces.
Right.
And only when there were witnesses did I recant and blame the person who I actually assaulted, who mercifully just appears to have broken his glasses and slightly injured his elbow.
And to Anna's point, in the room, there was, you hear this tittering and there's sort of laughter about it. And he maintains a solemnity, you know, because he's trying to sell that moment, sell that apology, as Ben says, maybe not such a great apology. And even as he's trying to sell it, there's more laughter in the room.
Right.
It's as though, and the other aspect of this, and I think Vox did a piece on this today, the macho that we celebrate in America can bring about a support and a frenzy that's really not healthy for this country.
No, it's not healthy, right? Because I also find it incredibly ironic that the same political party that's so distrustful of the government wants to take down, you know, the same people that are supposed to be speaking truth to power, reporting on the facts. Like, what do they want? Do they want state-sponsored media? Is that what they think is better? They think media is the enemy because media doesn't constantly tell them what they want to hear, right? And so if you think media is the enemy and you want to do away with independent reporters, reporters that aren't related to or tied to the government, what do you want? You want state-sponsored media? You think that's a good idea? They're just so incredibly, the way that they view things is so short-sighted and so irresponsible and goes against the Constitution. And I don't know if they're even aware of that. I don't even know if they realize what they're advocating for while they're celebrating the assault of a journalist.
Right. I think he just got a little ahead of himself and he did what he did and then he was like, oh. So now they're kind of using it as his platform. I think his career is going to be, you know, not as bright as he hoped. Maybe his governorship that he once maybe was gonna get is not gonna happen. They're definitely gonna hide him. Like, that's embarrassing. Yeah. Even if his people are laughing or whatever and he's making money, it's gonna be embarrassing for the rest of the people that he's serving with that don't approve of the
behavior. Yeah, and I would have said that maybe a couple of years ago, but I think that, you know, we've seen like one of the, perhaps the ultimate embarrassment, which was the Trump Access Hollywood tape. Mm-hmm. And it's bulletproof to those who supported him. Similarly here, I think in the state of Montana, those supporters, and they're substantial in number, will look past this incident.
Mm-hmm. And it will, so will those colleagues in Washington. They don't care. They don't care. This will be over. It won't matter. We've entered into a new world where nothing matters at all anymore. Today on, if I may, reading from Jim Newell's piece in Slate. Anna, just real quick, Rush Limbaugh described, this. I love this part. Do you have this by any chance?
I don't.
Okay, good. All right. So Rush Limbaugh described how Gianforte was, quote, manly, studly.
Wow. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
So that's funny to begin with. He took down a pajama boy journalist. I don't even know what that means. A 125-pound wet dish rag reporter and your average millennial man today. That's what Rush Limbaugh said. One caller to Rush said that if every Republican candidate threw a reporter to the ground, this is to what you were saying, we know they love it. Quote, it would increase my chances exponentially of voting for them. And on Fox News, an analyst called Jacobs a snowflake reporter. But the guy is, again, I'm stealing from Jim Newell, but the guy who lost his mind and committed assault.
Is studly.
He's studly and manly, and the other guy's a snowflake. You couldn't handle a question about a CBO score that you said, I'll give you my opinion as soon as the CBO score comes in. Then the day before the election, the guy's like, hey, the CBO scored in, it's now or never. And you decided to assault him, but the reporter's a snowflake.
Right, and also keep in mind that that statement about Gianforte being studly, right, is also coming from the same man who called Sandra Fluck a slut because she testified in front of Congress about the importance of accessible birth control, right? So like the double standards there. No, Rush Limbaugh, you're a snowflake where you can't even handle a woman testifying in front of Congress about birth control, so you have to resort to calling her a slut. But a man who can't handle a question from a reporter and goes ahead and assaults him for asking that question, that guy's a stud. I mean, they're just ridiculous. The double standards that you see in conservative arguments drives me absolutely crazy. Gianforte is not a stud.
No.
Okay?
No.
He is a snowflake. He is an incredible loser for not being able to handle that situation like an adult. You're running for Congress. You're running to be a representative, and this is the way you treat someone for asking you an incredibly simple question.
Yeah, he's gonna have disagreements with his colleagues, obviously, at times. Yeah. And that's why I said he's gonna have issues once he gets there. It's cute now, and his supporters think it's great, but he's not gonna be able to function in the environment that he's going into, where he's going to have to speak to people that don't agree with everything that he's saying.
I would agree with you, except he will never be challenged, and in that Republican caucus, no one will disagree with him because no one disagrees with anything unless they're to the right of the person they're talking to. There is no more reasonableness. There is no more, you know, the era of Republicans who you could, as a liberal, who I could think, well, I like Bob Dole, he's all right. I like Richard Lugar, he's okay. Alan Simpson, Howard Baker, on most issues I disagree with them. Mm-hmm. But you know, those guys were prepared to do the governing business of the nation. And those guys are gone. They left. Jim Jeffords was the symbol of that and thought, hey man, these guys, they're not playing anymore. They're not working. They're not interested in governing. Mm-hmm. And I'm out. And in the House in particular, there may be a couple, maybe in the Senate, if you stretch the definition of who those guys are and who those women are. But in the House, there are none, zero. So he'll be fine. They'll pat him on the back and they'll say, don't do something like that again. It embarrasses us. And that'll be the end of that.
Yeah. Well, just to give you an idea of the early voting involved in this special election, it's important to note that as of Wednesday night, this is right as the story was breaking that he had assaulted the reporter, 259,558 ballots had been returned. That number is of 357,596 absentee ballots sent out, meaning about 73% of absentee ballots are in. This is reporting from Wednesday night, by the way. So of approximately 700,000 Montana registered voters overall, 37 had cast their vote early. So that could have played a role as well.
Well, 70, and so that's 37% of eligible voters. Right, so it was 73% of people who actually voted.
Right.
So, you know.
So the die was cast really before the.
Yeah, you had a quarter of the electorate could have been influenced by that. And Quist apparently did, you know, we're not going to know for sure. He did a little better on election day than he had been doing, but not enough to overcome that. Yeah.
Right.
There's a slight, it's related, but, you know, Matt Taibbi has a really good piece in Rolling Stone, and Donald Trump is symbolic of it, and now Greg Gianforte is symbolic of it, and now Michael Grimm in New York, in Staten Island, the guy who threatened to break a reporter in half like a boy and throw him off a balcony while he was under a 20-count indictment, federal indictment, and then won by like 20 points or won by 13 points in a district with a well-funded Democrat. Like, I mean, the degree to which Democrats find ways to lose to these monsters, these are subhuman species. Donald Trump is not only in the best of us, he's in the bottom 6% of us, right? So is this guy. Right? So is Michael Grimm. And Democrats are finding ways to lose, and we're running the wrong candidates. And Rob Quist gave it what he could. I don't know that the National Party maybe could have been involved more, but they did eventually at least throw some of their weight behind it, unlike what they did in Kansas. But we have got to figure something out. Like, this is not being done correctly. And I'm here to the apparently large swath to my left that I was unaware of, to my left. You're right, my left. There's where we're gonna find some agreement that we need to talk about different things. We need to have, because these guys, if you can't beat Greg Gianforte, I got it. Redistricting these electoral districts are ridiculously drawn, drawn for guys like Greg Gianforte.
And judges are catching on to that.
Yes, mm-hmm. and we got a huge swath, and the Republicans are 10 times worse. But if we can't figure out. And they'll play dirty, but if we can't figure out a way to beat Michael Grimm and Greg Gianforte and Donald Trump, well then largely as a major contributory, impactful party in this country, we're done. And I think the way to do it is to speak to voters in a way that will impact them, impact their lives in a meaningful way.
And right, talk to them about stuff they care about.
Yeah. Sorry, and also fighting back and not being afraid of, you know, moving further to the left, right? I think that there are, look, Here's something that I witnessed this week that actually enraged me. NPR was having a discussion about how Democrats really need to soften their rhetoric. You know, their rhetoric has become a little too angry, a little too uncivil, and you know, we need to really reach across the aisle and work together. But do you think conservative talk radio is having conversations about how they really need to tone down their rhetoric and reach across the aisle to work with Democrats? They have no interest. They keep punching us in the face while we play patty cakes.
Well, right? Obama saw that from an administrative standpoint and political standpoint when he began his administration, his first 4 years, by trying to, in a sense, pre-compromise legislation to try to appeal to the other side. And he realized, not until it was too late, in my view, that they're not interested in compromising. They're going to take whatever you compromise and twist it.
We
need to put the banjo down. But it's two different things. It's not just rhetoric, because to some extent I agree with the NPR point, although I suspect I don't, because I know that their tone was a suggestion of compromise. But the language needs to be a language of economic justice.
Yes.
It can be, I don't care how much you try and compromise. You can compromise, try and compromise all day if you're trying to compromise about the right things. If you want to say to Republicans, hey, you claim to be populist. Donald Trump ran a populist campaign, said he was going to have health care for everybody, said he was going to reach out, said he was going to not cut taxes to anybody, was going to raise taxes on the rich. Great. Let's compromise on that. Here are our ideas. You want to talk? We have infrastructure ideas. We have ideas to reduce income inequality. And just let's talk about it and talk about it in a meaningful way with credible candidates who you believe. It's so the rhetoric can change a little, not that we have to be passive or back down to them, but eventually, and I'm a everything about Russia needs to be talked about, and because it's true, clearly, right? We don't know exactly what's true, but we know stuff is true, right? Right, but eventually, if you're going to win, you cannot run a campaign in 2018 where the focus of it is we hate Trump.
That's
right. You are going to have a campaign about things that matter to people in the way that Trump appeared in a totally phony, fraudulent way to be talking about things that matter to people.
Yeah, I think people are conflating the party's identity with the rhetoric. Like the party is having an identity crisis and they need to work on that and decide what it's going to be and then let the rhetoric align with that. Yeah. The identity of the party can't be like, what the are they doing?
Yeah.
You have to have your own agenda substantively in order to really push your rhetoric in a direction that's appropriate.
Yeah,
that's
I totally agree. And there is an identity crisis. I think that there is still a pretty noticeable divide within the Democratic Party. And for me, it's not even about we need to win as Democrats. It's about having ideas that matter, being a party of ideas that matter to most Americans. We want to represent most Americans and their best interests. Right now, we have a party in charge that is not looking out for the best interests of most Americans.
And they have strong ideas. That's why they're winning. Their ideas are clear. Their identity is clear. You know, they want a wall. They want this. They have things that are clear.
Yeah.
And our party is like, well, we just don't like the stuff that they're doing.
Right.
That's exactly. That's
never going to work.
Read Matt Taibbi's piece in Rolling Stone. It's excellent. It's short, taking about 9 minutes, and it's right.
Yeah,
100%.
Just like everything else Matt Taibbi writes. He's amazing. Anyway, all right, let's move on to some other news. Texas Governor Greg Abbott just recently signed a bill into law that reduces the licensing fees for handguns. Now, while he was doing a little bit of a press event for this bill, he said something a little questionable. I'll get to his statement in just a second, but first, take a look at this video of him shooting a handgun.
I could watch that all afternoon.
Yeah, boy,
that was running again, or is that
great?
That was so studly.
I was starting to get a little excited. It was sort of disturbing.
Okay, so anyway, there were reporters obviously filming that and you know tweeting about what was going on, and then something really stood out. Okay, Greg Abbott said the following in a jokey manner, but it's a little too soon considering what just happened with Greg Gianforte in Montana. He said, I'm gonna carry this around in case I see any reporters. He had a gun in his hand, right? Wow, you guys discussed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he's signaling some type of regime change, because if there's no freedom of press, then we're not in a democracy anymore.
Right.
So I don't know, that's
I would normally
pretty bad joke.
A year ago, I would have been like, he's kidding, he's joking. And naturally, adversarial relationship between the governor, especially this governor, and people interested in the truth, right? Because he's because we know what he is. But you know, in general, okay, if you leave that out, there's an adversarial relationship between politicians and the press. So you make that joke, don't care, let it go. Not the greatest joke, believe me, there are worse. But in light of Donald Trump's open hostility to reporters, and I don't exempt Barack Obama from the mistakes that they made with journalists either. If you think it's the same, again, you are burying your head in the sand. There is a palpable shift in attitude where we've said it, we've winked at people and said, you go ahead, you stand. You know, the way reporters were treated at Trump rallies, the way the people at Trump rallies treated reporters, the way Greg Gianforte treated Ben Jacobs, and a number of other cases of reporters being strong-armed, manhandled. That reporter who got arrested, was it in when he tried to question Tom Price? Was that in Texas too? I feel like that was in Texas, but I might be mistaken about that. Reporter arrested because he was asking Tom Price, Secretary now of Health and Human Services, I believe, trying to ask him questions. As he walked down the hallway, the guy had his credentials were literally hanging around. He's been a reporter for like 19 years there. Everybody knows him. Arrested. So yeah, then it becomes a little less funny. As a side note, I can't think of a worse way to spend my time than going to a media event. I mean, that's why I'm not a local reporter anymore.
Yeah.
Standing in there, and I'd be like, I watched the governor fire off
six
rounds.
Doing that? Right, just film the like a repetitive.
And then we'll put it on TV because it's the. You think they'll use that as a natural sound break mark there in between their piece?
Right.
Yeah, but for Governor Abbott, choom choom. He says it's time to get tough, choom choom, on crime, choom choom.
And lacking from that story will be any kind of what you'll get here, any or you know presumably and maybe in a few other places. A discussion of the situation with gun laws there, and as Ben says, it's going to be played as a tough on crime, and the machismo of that moment is something that will be allowed to play unquestioned. I'm with Ben on this. You know, really, quite recently, I would have thought, come on, the guy's joking around, like you know, he's referencing an adversarial relationship. But the truth is that this adversarial relationship, good-natured adversarial relationship that Washington and politicians have had with the press has become a pretty ugly matter. I mean, to the point that I think you have to note everyone who deals with the press and in public that you can't make these jokes anymore.
I mean, reporters barely even challenge politicians that much, right? Like, think about the whole Gianforte thing and how the reporter's question was just incredibly tame. It was a simple question about, hey, what do you think about this new analysis of the healthcare replacement? Loses his mind over that, right? Well, but the reason why I'm even bringing that up is, don't let these politicians convince you, regardless of what your political ideology is, don't let them convince you that media is the enemy and we should do away with them. If you buy into that argument, you are actually working against yourself, right? The media is not the enemy. The media is supposed to hold elected officials and people in power accountable for their actions. They're supposed to inform you and give you information about what's really going on. If you do away with the media, first of all, you do away with something that's protected under the Constitution. And secondly, you do away with something that's supposed to help you as a US citizen, right? Don't let someone like Greg Abbott or Greg Abbott.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, they're both Gregs.
They're both Gregs.
It just hit me right now. Don't let someone like Greg Abbott or Greg Gianforte, you know, change the narrative of what journalism is supposed to be and how important media really is.
Yeah, that's the one piece too, because it goes to what you're saying. With the Abbott thing and the shooting, I don't know her name, but she works with CNN. Kyung La, she was out in front of the polling places when Gianforte and the race was happening in Montana. One of the things she pointed out was the Montana voters are coming in. Many of them were talking about how they're still going to vote for him, or they're even more likely to vote for him. One of them said, because when they found out that she is from CNN, you're lucky someone doesn't pop one of you to her face as they're walking in to vote. So it goes beyond just, the governor of Texas decided to shoot off some rounds and talk about how he's such a good shot and then threaten reporters. No, citizens who think they're supporting you think you're giving them a call to arms to do this to people. So this is when things like this happen.
This is a great point. There's a tweet which we could put up, we'll find, from today from Mark Sanford, former governor of South Carolina, now a congressman who did the Appalachian Trail nonsense. He has an amusing history. But nonetheless, Sanford today pointed out that he's hearing from constituents who essentially are saying that the anger and venom, he was talking about racism generally, but it certainly applies to reporters too, that because Donald Trump can say it, not just racism, sexism, all of the isms, that he's like, hey man, the president gets to say whatever he wants and gets away with it. Why can't I? Like the notion that Donald Trump, that his worldview and his manner of talking about women and talking about Mexicans and talking about and starting in the 80s talking about black people and obviously and talking about Islam, that his sort of freedom to do this in a cavalier, reckless, harmful, destructive way. Forget harmful, I'm not talking about people's emotions. I'm talking about the impact that then it has on policy and on their lives. That it's not gonna have some, that it's not gonna slide down and that we're, which we have seen in that exact moment that JR describes of a person feeling comfortable saying to a reporter from CNN, you're lucky somebody doesn't pop you.
Right. I mean, to your point, I agree with you, Anna. People don't understand that oppressing the press is actually like a human rights violation, because that's what it's for. It's to allow the populace to understand and be able to investigate what's going on and go places they can't go and ask questions they can't ask. So I think to the extent that people understand that it's actually not allowing a free press is a human rights violation. It's that serious. It's not just an individual person from the media that you're like, oh, well, we're all, you know, upset because, oh, this one person was harmed, or this other reporter was harmed, or the CNN reporter was threatened. Right. It's actually a whole entire system that the democracy is relying upon.
But
to Anna's other point quickly, I think the notion that the press has been watered down is really the a huge notion that one should understand. We're not even talking about a press that's legitimately adversarial in any kind of meaningful way.
Right.
The press has been defanged in this country. It's been defanged for a lot of different reasons. Most of them have to do with commercialism. But that's why conversations like this don't really go on in mainstream media. Well, but having said that, it becomes even more loathsome. You know, you turn on a press that really isn't even that effective.
Right.
You know, but it's now, first of all, I think we should acknowledge that, like, there's been a rebirth of some serious journalism, especially in print, that if there's anything, there's nothing good that comes out of Donald Trump. But one of the symptoms of Donald Trump that is that I can live with is that there's an attempt to refang the press. The obstacles to that undermined press effectiveness for the last 37 years are not going away. So it's going to be an endlessly uphill climb. But there is certainly in print and at some significant publications online also, a more adversarial relationship, and that's welcomed. But after 37 years, starting basically in the Reagan administration, of an attempt led by Rush Limbaugh, who we talked about in an earlier story today, and then followed up by Fox News whenever they launched in 1990 and started ruining the world. And, you know, Mark Levin and all these sort of hateful guys on talk radio saying, the press is lying to you. They're dishonest. They're not you. They're not with you. They're leftists and should not be believed. And academics are leftists and should not be believed. And scientists are leftists and should not be believed. Essentially taking three of the most knowledgeable groups of people that we have in this country. They'd already done it to lawyers, right? That one was easier. But you take these groups of people who sort of dedicated their lives to learning things and then sharing their knowledge with other people. And Rush Limbaugh led a movement that Fox followed and picked up the mantle on to spread disinformation about them, to undermine their credibility. And what do you know? It worked.
It worked
100%. Yes. And Donald Trump is the creation, is the magical gift that 37 years of disinformation gave to this country.
Right, absolutely. And that propaganda has worked, and it was very obvious during the past election, where if you even attempted to provide evidence, you know, against someone like Donald Trump, you were immediately brushed off as elitist, as someone who doesn't understand, you know, a certain population of America. And it was frustrating, because how do you convince people that are already so sure that you're working against them, mm-hmm. right? Like, how do you convince them that, no, I'm not against you, I'm not an elitist, I'm just trying to give you information so you make a smart choice. And it's very difficult to fight back against that propaganda, because it did seep into society and it's been very effective.
Yeah. And no one helped the lawyers when we were being bashed, but when the Muslim ban happened, The lawyers were the people who had to run to the airports and sit down and type petitions on the laptop for free. The evil, terrible underbelly of the world. The lawyers, you know, are there on the front line of the Constitution. And not to toot lawyers' horns, but they're gonna have to rescue the media. Like, when the First Amendment is gonna start to be suppressed, it's the lawyers that are gonna have to step up and do the petitions and go to the Supreme Court and make it right and fix it.
Yeah.
So,
well, they're good lawyers and bad lawyers too.
There's
they're good journalists and bad journalists too.
Right.
And TV
just like
journalism,
any other field of work.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I'm not defending all journalists. I'm just saying, as a rule, don't disbelieve something because it came from a reporter. And we're not getting any help from some on the left in that regard either.
Exactly. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, an update on the Russia investigations. Apparently, someone very close to Trump is now involved in those investigations. And then later on, we will get to the Saudi arms deal and where that deal is actually going to create jobs. It's not in the US. Come right back. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to TYT. Anna, Mark, Suann, and Ben with you. And JR's here, too. You're on the stage. I should definitely introduce you, even though you're not at the desk. Just hanging out.
Yeah, if the shot could just go like 4 inches further over, you'd see him.
Yeah. All right, guys. I want to get to the next story because later on in this hour, we have to hear from Representative Rosa DeLauro. She questioned Betsy DeVos during these hearings, and it's amazing. You do not want to miss that. All right, so Jared Kushner is now under scrutiny in the Russia probe. He is a person that they're looking into, a subject of the investigation. However, there are very few details as to why it is that he's now included in this investigation. Investigators do believe that Kushner has significant information relevant to their inquiry, officials said. That does not mean they suspect him of a crime or intend to charge him. Now, the reason why they're questioning him, or at least plan to question him, is because of some meetings that he had with Russian officials last December. The official said Kushner is in a different category from former Trump aides Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn, who are formerly considered subjects of the investigation. A subject of an investigation is a person whose conduct is within the scope of a grand jury's investigation. Now, Mr. Kushner previously volunteered to share with Congress what he knows about these meetings that he had with Russia. He will do the same if he is contacted in connection with any other inquiry. So in December, he met with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak and also with Russian banker Sergei Gorkov.
He runs essentially the state-run bank.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, look, we don't know, you know, to what extent he's suspected of doing anything shady. We just know that now he is part of this investigation. And it seems like things keep getting worse for Trump and his administration. But again, we don't know all the details of what's going on.
But we know that he's done something shady by looking at him. But you can't say that.
You can't say that.
That's not like, you can't use that in court,
you
right?
You could use that instead of him saying to the committee, I'll speak to you. He is speaking through his lawyer.
Yeah,
sometimes people don't like that. They're like, you lawyered up. That means you did something.
Just so to be clear, and Sue-Ann knows this, but so he's not a subject of the investigation.
Right.
A target is when they're coming and they're about to indict you. And subject is what Manafort and Flynn are, and he's something less than that, like a witness.
Did I call him a subject?
You did at one point,
but
then you did at another.
Yeah,
you clarified it later, but just so he, but also that's where what we know now. And just to be clear, people have worked their way up that ladder,
right?
As investigations,
you can start. You're saying just as sort of a person of interest,
and of course the meetings that were had with Russian officials before December are also interesting and relevant because that would be during the campaign.
Yeah,
I think things are. You know, there would be a logical reason for Jared Kushner to meet with Kislyak after the election. He's about to be the top aide to the president. But interesting is that they care about the meeting with the banker because we know that there is a significant, or there is a, and I won't say significant. We know there's a financial aspect to this investigation. Mm-hmm. The Treasury Department was folded in, so the money is a factor in this investigation. So the meeting with the banker might actually be more relevant, but who knows?
There's a lot. There are a lot of Trump and Kushner related holdings that have foreign governments involved with them. We knew that before this election went down, and now that the election has gone down, it's a little tough to tell where there might be a conflict of interest. You know, that pay-to-play thing that they broiled Hillary Clinton for, her foundation getting funding, and then in return for apparent favors. Well, it looks like that's going down in the Trump administration
now. That's right. Everything that she got criticized for, they're doing 100 times worse. You know, like the Kushner properties pitch in China and trying to convince Chinese investors to spend $500,000 on Kushner properties so they can get their golden visa. I mean, that is obviously a huge conflict of interest. And Jared Kushner was someone that was mentioned during those pitches, which they weren't supposed to do, right? Mm-hmm. And so these types of issues keep coming up. I know that's not related to Russia, but the whole pay to play thing is worrisome. And it's especially frustrating when it has to do with things like housing and property and real estate here in the US, decisions about who gets to come here as an immigrant, and you know, refugees who get turned away because they're not, you know, millionaires or billionaires who can pay $500,000 for a golden visa. Like, all this stuff is incredibly frustrating. And so I'm glad that there's an investigation. I don't know how much wrongdoing there is on Jared Kushner's end, but he is now part of it. And so we'll see how it all plays out.
Yeah, in terms of those conflicts, it's so worrisome and frustrating that guess what? It's in the Constitution.
Right.
Yeah. Who knew the Emoluments Clause? There it is right there. You cannot have these conflicts and be a president.
Yet the Emoluments, clause is one of those things that is gray area enough that there is some wiggle room for them.
Well,
isn't it
gray area because it's never been litigated. It hasn't been litigated since the 1800s. Supposedly a president got like a horse or something from Spain. So it just hasn't been an issue because there's never been a president that has a cloud of all these conflicts, all these business conflicts spread throughout the world. It's never happened. Hasn't made it that far. So I think that's why it hasn't been litigated. So it'd be interesting to see who has standing to actually get this issue heard.
And I don't want to pretend like I care in the sense that about like, I'm not outraged by this. These are all things we knew about Trump. Mm-hmm. He's gross, right? Mm-hmm. I want him gotten, and whatever it takes. If that makes me, if that makes this purely political, yeah, bring it on. This is purely political for the good of America. I hope Robert Mueller finds something, and the sooner the better.
Yep. All right. Let's move on to the arms deal with Saudi Arabia. Earlier this week, news broke that Donald Trump engaged with Saudi Arabia over an arms deal. Now, arms deals between the United States and Saudi Arabia is nothing new. It happened under the Obama administration, and some in the media, us included, criticized him for it. But when it comes to Saudi Arabia, it's a little interesting considering the fact that Trump has been very negative toward Muslims. He wants to ban travel from predominantly Muslim countries. Saudi Arabia, of course, is not included in that travel ban. So why is it that he wants to, you know, facilitate an arms deal with a Muslim majority country like Saudi Arabia? Well, defense contractors Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Dynamics are all involved in the estimated $110 billion deal, the biggest in US history. The deal is the latest in a long line of US military aid for Saudi Arabia, which of course has recently fueled the country's involvement in Yemen's civil war. Now, how did Donald Trump sell this arms deal to the American public? Here is his statement. He said, tremendous investments in the United States, hundreds of billions of dollars of investments into the United States and jobs, jobs, jobs. So, hey, let's give Saudi Arabia weapons because we're going to create jobs in the US, which in my opinion isn't even a great argument. But if you do think it's a great argument, keep in mind that a little bit of an investigation by our reporter Naomi LaChance found that these jobs are actually not even going to be created in the United States. They're going to be created in Saudi Arabia. So let me give you the details about that. The State Department said the deal is potentially supporting tens of thousands of new jobs in the United States. But the deal includes a $6 billion agreement for 150 Black Hawk helicopters, but Lockheed Martin says it will manufacture them at its plant in Saudi Arabia.
Lockheed Martin has a plant in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, but there'll probably be some American guys working security there, some jobs there, probably.
Translators.
That's right, some translators, that's right, yeah. Of course.
Of course.
It's just an alternative fact, you guys. Jeez. Yeah. Relax.
Just real quick before I continue on, or before we continue on, you guys should check out Naomi's full piece on this at TYT Politics, youtube.com/TYT Politics. She did an incredible job with this. We have more facts, but Ben, jump in.
I was giving $110 billion to Saudi Arabian arms. It's like it's never in the past created a ton of American jobs.
That's
like
right.
So why would it all of a sudden create them? Now, that said, you know, I mean, we, I think all at this table, I don't know because I just met Suanne today, but you know, so I won't speak for you. I'll speak for them because I'm tired of hearing them. But they want to hear me more, which is weird.
It is
strange. But like, so creating these jobs, the jobs are obviously going to be created in Saudi Arabia, right? But there is a potential benefit for that, even though presumably we would all like to see us rethink this relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
But the idea, the notion, if we're going to continue with the kind of world we live in, then there's a benefit to having Saudi Arabian jobs created, because the fact of the matter is there's a tremendous amount of unemployment in Saudi Arabia. It's young unemployment. And Saudi Arabia is keenly aware that if they don't transition their economy to something a little more meaningful and not just a petroleum-based economy, that they got to employ these people, because they fear the same thing that swept across the Middle East 4 years ago, which is some sort of Arab Spring in Saudi Arabia. And believe me, that's an unpleasant outcome for a lot. And certainly it is a completely unpleasant outcome for the military industrial complex, the intelligence industrial complex, the national security apparatus of the United States. And I don't say that like those guys are always wrong. Sometimes they're right. And maybe they're right on that, that that's not something that we would look forward to. So there is an upside in creating these Saudi Arabian jobs, even though that is almost certainly not a political winner. No, hey, yeah, I'm the guy who created like a 40,000 Saudi jobs, man.
Well, also 2020. These Saudi jobs, I mean, when you talk about sort of reinvigorating or beginning to resuscitate a Saudi Arabian economy in some way, doing it with this military may not be the way that you'd want to sustain that economy, right? Essentially, what we're doing is building a Saudi Air Force, and we're allowing them to have independence. Now, this is sort of a meta picture of the Middle East, but a Saudi Air Force and a strong Saudi economy based on sort of their own military industrial complex may not be the healthiest thing for the region.
Maybe $110 billion worth of schools.
That might
be another way to go.
Yeah.
Then they can have some construction jobs.
There are a lot of other economic engines besides
that we could put. I agree completely.
Well, let me give you guys some more information based on Naomi's reporting on this. So the agreement also focuses on helping Saudi Arabia build its own air force, meaning that much of the work will be done there. Now, keep in mind that from 2014 to 2016, Boeing's workforce actually decreased 15,000 workers, even as its revenues increased from $60 billion to $65
billion. That's a wild
automation.
Huh?
Automation, right?
Yeah, automation.
They don't need as many employees.
So like this argument that like, hey, we gotta like, if we create more contracts for these weapons manufacturers and these, you know, private contractors, they're gonna create more jobs, but that has not played out. That is the exact opposite has happened, and automation has definitely played a role in that. Also, Raytheon promised that the deal will bring job creation in both the US and Saudi Arabia. The contractor will provide air defense systems, precision munitions, and cybersecurity. Raytheon's agreement, however, creates an entirely new subsidiary company, Raytheon Arabia, which will not only be based in Saudi Arabia, but will help the kingdom build its own military technology in the future. What a great idea, by the way. Saudi Arabia, which by the way, you know, played a role in, you know,
15
what happened.
15 of the 19.
Yeah, exactly. 15 of the 19. 9/11, you want to have a conversation about that. You want to have a conversation about national security and how, you know, Republicans are going to be super tough on national security. We have now created a deal with Saudi Arabia where we're training them to create, you know, the same military capabilities that we have here in the US. Real smart, but whatever. I mean,
no, it's a great point. It's about the money.
Yeah.
It's about the money. I mean, and by the way, it's always been about the money. Obviously, this country has chosen allies and interests, geopolitical areas of focus based on money, on what will be important to our economy and those that run it. And I use that wording deliberately. This is the most naked example of that. And we're going to see more naked examples of it because we've got a guy in charge who's Daddy Warbucks, you know, who's Richie Rich, and all of his Richie Rich pals are now making these moves, and they can make them so nakedly without any repercussions that they will continue to make them.
You know, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who works at a TV station, and even when I started in this business, or when Mark and I started in this business, there was this sense of like, of course there was an effort to produce a profit and deliver for shareholders. But at the same time, there was also an effort to deliver a quality product that everybody who worked there could be proud of and make some money and pay a staff a living wage so there could be some meaningful quality of life. At least in television, for example, which is the business that I grew up knowing, here what we have left is the first or the second thing. increase, deliver for the shareholders, whichever one of the three that was, one, two, or three. That's all we got left. They don't care about the product anymore, and they certainly don't care about quality of life. Now, I presume that that they'll be delivering a quality product here, right? Mm-hmm. The weapons will blow the shit out of everybody in their path, and won't that be great, right? But they don't care, like you'd think, you know, it wasn't that long ago that there was some standard that when Boeing got all that money and increased their profits, it wouldn't occur to them to cut 15,000 jobs because they now can't, right? But now, like, of course, you cut. There is no sense of loyalty. 15,000 people they fired, yeah, while they made $5 billion extra dollars. Who gets that money? They give a raise to the other employees?
No, they're building underground shelters for the top executives because they're going to need somewhere to live when all these weapons are going off. So,
man, it is. We went off the rails, man. That's why, you know, I had lunch last week with some super rich people. I know we got to go, and I was like, the world I want is a world where you guys are still rich, but you're just less rich. Like, what do you care if you're worth $65 million or $38 million? I don't care. Right. You can be worth $38 million. And you know what's happened to that $27 million? We're redistributing it.
Yeah.
In a meaningful, effective way.
All right. We got to take another break. Let's do that. And when we come back, the videos that I promise you, Representative Rosa DeLauro just going ham on Betsy DeVos.
I love it.
Come back. Since we fighting with the cougars, and yes, we don't die, we multiply. And army of supermen, all the rest like cougars, right? And our hands, they are kicking it all night. A TYT fan made that song for us years ago, actually. And TYT, we don't die, we multiply.
Yeah.
Interesting line. I actually love the song.
Just like Bebe's kids.
All right, some TYT lives for you guys. Alex says, obviously, there'll be no jobs for Americans. Obviously, glad we are giving Saudi a leg up. Also, I am Sock says, does he think ending tweets or sentences with jobs magically makes jobs appear?
Yes.
I don't know if he does, but
no. But he believes that. By the way, that's better than even a smart-ass comment. That actually is deliberate in terms of trying to message.
That's
he's
the message.
Messaging,
right?
And he does it effectively. Jobs effectively messages for Trump. Of course, it is absurd considering it's demonstrably the case that he's not creating jobs. Mm-hmm. But those tweet messages are the things that are replayed, and they do further his message.
We went to my wife and I went to a tour to school this week to see about whether it'd be a good fit for our daughter, who's still, you know, like a year away from starting like first grade or kindergarten or wherever the hell they start. I don't even know.
be careful because there's some budget cuts in them schools. You got to check now.
I think people will be comforted to know my wife's basically in charge of this process. but we toured we went to the first grade, went to second grade, third grade, and like by the time we got to fourth grade, and like that works out, and you can look through the homework and their projects, and like there was a thing called My Heroes, which was awesome, and people would name like Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, or you know, Babe Ruth, a lot of Martin Luther King, right? And then it'd be like a sports figure and or a friend, and it was kind of nice. But like you'd read through some of them, and I was like, the fourth grade, this sounds like Trump, like the way the kid write. I like Martin Luther King because he did great things for lots of people, black people and white people. He was a great man and wanted everyone to have a better life in America.
That sounds like
Donald
Trump.
Yeah, right.
Right. Like, jobs.
Just think of the end.
Jobs.
Yeah. Right, exactly. But then he was assassinated. Sad. You know, I mean, like you could have ended it like that. I mean, it was remarkable how dim this guy is.
Yeah.
Or how great those fourth graders were.
Right.
They're all presidential.
Message. Yeah. He's staying on message. So. Yeah.
Sometimes, yeah, that's true.
It's alternative facts, but it's a message.
That's definitely true.
All right, let's get to Betsy DeVos.
Speaking of fifth graders.
Betsy DeVos is dealing with some pretty tough questioning from representatives regarding her education policies and the fact that under the White House's newly released budget proposal, education would lose about $9.3 billion in funding. Now, one representative who's not happy about this is Representative Rosa DeLauro. She is a Democrat from Connecticut. And let's go to video 6, where she kind of gives it to Betsy DeVos in a very aggressive fashion. Take a look.
This is a budget, and I characterized it, Mr. Chairman, in the Ag Appropriations Committee this morning. It is cruel, it is inhumane, and it is heartless. A $9.2 billion cut to education. And the fact of the matter is there one, when my colleague talked about there's 10%, there's less money going to high poverty areas. The teachers are more likely to be novices in these places. Those underserved areas are going to be hurt. We're none of us in here going to be hurt. We're going to be fine. Our kids and our grandkids are going to be okay. But millions of kids around this country are going to suffer what has been done with a $9.2 billion cut to our education programs, which is supposed to serve our youngsters, make sure they have a good future and a bright future. And I'm going to fight this budget, Mr. Chairman, with every fiber of my body, because it is wrong to do this to our kids.
With absolutely no respect to Betsy DeVos, I just don't think she understands what she's doing. Like, I'm okay with learning on the job. That's fine. Sometimes people get to do that. But she just really doesn't understand her position and what she's supposed to be doing. And it's sad. Like, I don't rock with her fundamentally because she didn't know what a HBCU was, and I went to a HBCU, so I already had a problem with her. But this, I'm like, you are over public education and you're cutting it. That is counterintuitive to your job description.
Right.
Like, she's supposed to be improving the situation, not cutting funds from her own budget. Like, what is she doing? Tying herself up? Like, what, is she a magician?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that there are some... there are some areas where she does know what she's doing, and she's been influencing, you know, education in Michigan for some time now by, you know, pushing it toward privatization or pushing it toward charters. And that has been a political passion of hers. And so I have no doubt that she knows what she's doing when it comes to that. And I've talked about this a little bit before. When it comes to the education department, they don't primarily focus on policy that impacts grade schools. Usually that's up to the states. But what they're doing right now is they are trying to influence or at least incentivize states to push toward school choice, these vouchers and these charter schools, in order to get federal funding. Right. And so that will have an impact on what states ultimately decide. And the fact that they're going to cut $9.3 billion from education shows you where their priorities are. They don't care about giving you school choice. They care about privatizing. They care about, you know, making sure that none of this money or less of this money goes towards students who want to go to college and can't afford it. It's just, it's bad all around. And yeah, she's incompetent when it comes to certain things, like understanding how government works. And it's been very clear based on, you know, some of the answers that she's given, or understanding like the proper way to fend off bears. She's been really bad at answering those questions as well. But I think, you know, in some regard, she does know what she's doing, and it's actually really dangerous.
Right. She's nudging toward privatization, as Anna says, and she's nudging toward charter schools. Those are the two things she's been unapologetic about, and she's clearly trying to continue that now that she is in an extremely powerful position in government.
Yeah, I don't think it's okay to learn on a job. I mean, it's okay to learn on some jobs.
I mean, yeah. What, like McDonald's, they can like show you where to put the stuff in the fryer, but not this job.
Also, but if it's harmless.
Or president.
Like
president.
Right, totally. But I mean, even like things I care about, like you could learn on the job to be a baseball broadcaster. Your company might suffer and people be like, this guy didn't know anything about baseball. Mm-hmm. But nobody's hurt by this, right? People are irritated by it, but you know, this is I was just looking up there, you know, this is like it turns out the 88th
richest. I just want to say that this graphic is everything.
Yeah, totally, the graphic is nice. They're the 88th richest family in the country. These are not people, they've given her life, she didn't care about education. This is not, if you were serious about governing, and Trump isn't, and the people he appointed, and they're serious about ungoverning. And obviously, if you ask Betsy DeVos, the agency she runs, Department of Education, yes or no, up or down, get rid of the Department of Education. It's in your power. She'd get rid of it.
Right.
Right. They'd like not to have it. Republicans for years, they don't want a Department of Education. They'd like to leave it up to the states. Some states will thrive in that, and many states simply won't. They will not spend the money. But that's what she would like to do. They want to ungovern. Ben Carson wants to ungovern. right? Scott Pruitt wants to ungovern. They're not interested in governing. That's why it's stunning. That's why John, guy like John Kasich stood out so much. He's a conservative Republican, disagree with him on everything. He seems to have an interest in running things. You know, he'd like the government to work at least. And this brand of the Republican Party, this wing of the Republican Party, which is now fully in charge of the party, they don't want to govern. Mm-hmm. They want so much less government that they don't want to do it. And this is a, these are real jobs. There are conservatives who at least know something about education, but they want to destroy the teachers union, and they think teachers are the bad guys, and they want everybody to go to private school. That's what they would like. That would be their ultimate goal. And because deep down they think public school is a giant failure and that we can't fix it and we can't get it right in America.
I don't even think that they believe that. I mean, they consistently defund public education and then funnel that taxpayer money into private schools, which effectively, you know, you rip out the resources from anything, and of course it's going to start failing, right? I don't think that they see public schools as a failure. I think that they see public schools as institutions that need to abide by, you know, the Constitution. You can't teach religion in these public schools. They absolutely hate that. They don't want these kids learning about evolution. They don't want them learning about climate change. They want these kids to learn about creationism and whatever garbage, you know, they believe in their own households. And that's the problem. Like, that's my biggest issue. They don't have any interest in reforming education so it teaches kids quality curriculum. They want to reform it so it essentially teaches them or indoctrinates them the way that they want kids to be indoctrinated in this country. That's the real problem. And also, they don't want their taxpayer money to go to education. They want to hoard the wealth for themselves. It's not enough that she's, you know, I don't even know how much she's worth, but you mentioned
$88 billion.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, wow, yeah, that's not enough. She's got to hoard more of that wealth for herself.
I'm sorry.
I do like that you said that Rosa went for
Betsy. $5.4 billion. Sorry.
That you said that Rosa DeLauro went for Betsy DeVos. How calm and like nice was she? She's like, it's inhumane and cruel. Like, there's so many things you could really, really say about a nine, that cut to education. I like what she said. I appreciate that she, you know, spoke up. I just want us to get out of this, like, let's be so nice. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not making me feel galvanized against her. I'm galvanized against it because it's wrong and I understand numbers. But I feel like we need to get in the game of like messaging and theming and calling it what it is. Like, that is a hustle. That's horrible, you know, for the country. That's gonna ruin things for people. Like, kids are not gonna be able to go to school. Like, it's gonna be a problem.
Right.
Like, call it what it is. Don't couch it and call it inhumane. Like, say what it is.
Wow, who would have thought that the rhetoric of calling something inhumane is too soft?
It's too soft.
You're saying you would explain to people in that moment that you have them what this actually does to kids.
But, you know, this is going to destroy people who can't afford to pay for private school.
It's gonna destroy opportunities for people who are, you know, underprivileged. Let's just keep it real, right? If you don't have the money to pay for grade school, private grade school, you're not even gonna get a chance to get educated. And more importantly, if you do have the money to afford private school, those schools don't have to abide by really important standards, you know, scientific standards, for instance, in these science classes. By the way, we all understand how serious this is, but one person who apparently thinks this is a joke is Representative Tom Cole. Take a look at his reaction and response to DeLauro's line of questioning.
And I'm going to fight this budget, Mr. Chairman, with every fiber of my body because it is wrong to do this to our kids.
I have no doubt. Madam Secretary, I just want to thank you very much for being here today. I want to thank you for your testimony, for your professionalism. I particularly love the emphasis on choice and frankly trying to give as many options to young people as we possibly can. And you certainly laid that out robustly in your budget. I know you've had to make some tough decisions. We actually have three cabinet level jurisdictions here, and we're given an allocation and we end up having to make a lot of tough decisions too. So we certainly have a great deal of sympathy for that. We want to see you succeed because we think your success represents the success of America's students. We know you care about that deeply. You've demonstrated that over a lifetime. We know the president cares about that, and we look forward to working with you in that common endeavor as we go forward.
You think?
See how he went in and he stood up for her. He's like, "You're amazing. You're wonderful." Yeah. He didn't couch it. He was
"You're
the bomb."
On DeVos's ass he kissed it. I mean, it's amazing.
First, he diminishes DeLauro with that comment.
He's like, "Oh, whatever."
I'm sure you will. So, and then he goes on to, as you say,
So I mean, it doesn't matter what she says because the die is cast for what kind of budget's going to come out of this administration. With a Republican-controlled House and a Republican-controlled Senate, the Senate will mitigate a tiny, tiny little bit. But we started this show, and believe me, I'm not calling you out. I just reminded of it with a story about Greg Gianforte who body slammed the reporter in Montana. You think Tom Cole's going to give a guy like Greg Gianforte a tough time when he comes in?
Right.
Like, I mean, that's who's in the House. Mm-hmm. Tom Cole is a perfect. Representation of Republicans in the House.
But Rosa is there.
She's there.
Step it up a notch.
But I mean, it doesn't matter. You could scream, you could strip. Makes no difference. It makes no difference. The Democrats in the House are largely powerless to stop an extreme right-wing agenda and a lunchbox for a Secretary of Education with nice glasses. I'll give her that. And they're not going to stop it. Our the only hope is that, you know, the Ben Sasses and the Jeff Flakes and the Susan Collinses of the world, that they're going to save us, and John McCain, and that is
that's so devastating.
That's so depressing.
I know,
but that's where that's where our hope is with both the Health Care Act and with this budget that the Senate will mitigate slightly. But this stuff's going to pass, and Trump's going to sign it, and that's why opposing him every step of the way and weakening him politically. And getting him out of office matters because when there is no political strength there, you undermine everything. So don't stop. Don't give him political wins. Don't give him any political wins. And get this guy out of office before he does further damage to this great country.